You are listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst. Your deep dive into the global art world. Thoughtful, intentional, and always ready to play.
Hello, and welcome to Fair Enough, a podcast series by Art Cologne in collaboration with Texte zur Kunst. Fair Enough brings together artists, curators, writers, and thinkers to reflect on how art and its institutions are responding to the urgencies of our present moment. This season, marking the 35th anniversary of Texte zur Kunst, we're taking up the journal's motto for the year, "There is no art without criticism." Each episode returns to a past issue of the journal to revisit the debates it sparked and to consider how those questions continue to shape the cultural and political landscape today. Today's conversation reflects back on Texte zur Kunst's first issue on the avant-garde and mass culture that was published in September 1990. My name is Michaela Dixon, and I am your host, and today we are joined by Tara Heffernan. Tara is an art historian and critic currently completing a PhD at the University of Melbourne on the work of post-war Italian artist Piero Manzoni. Published widely, her art criticism focuses on modernism and the avant-garde's conceptual art and the continuing lineages of cultural bohemianism. In 2024, she guest-edited issue 18.1 of On Magazine and was a judge for the Darling Portrait Prize at the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra. She's currently working on an anthology of writings on kitsch in the 21st century, editing a collection of essays by Catherine Liu, and serves as the secretary and managing editor for the Palm Springs School for Social Research, which will officially launch in mid-2026. Tara, thank you for joining us today. For the listeners, I first wanted to start by contextualizing the essay that you wrote for UN Projects that was called Badeau Writing, Art Criticism and the Capitalist Subject. Would you give a brief summary of the article and maybe briefly talk about the issue that you edited on the topic of the Badeau in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So this came about, I suppose, in 2024. I'd started making the plans probably mid to late 2023. In terms of the issue, I had thought about a number of different things. I'd thought about kitsch. I'd thought about Philistinism, which was sort of following from Vladimir Nabokov. I'd really wanted it to be something as an issue that somehow reflected on criticism in terms of the idea of like commentary and critique, not necessarily just like art criticism as a subject, but it felt like the perfect opportunity for me to put my own writing in and write something about Badeau writing, which I suppose I've been thinking about in terms of a number of things, like particularly it was first person narrative style art criticism. So the kind of criticism which would be like, oh, you know, I was hungover slash still drunk on the tram on my way to the gallery. And then, you know, I saw the celebrity, blah, 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 that kind of thing. But also like a series of other things like TikTok, art edutainment, I guess Substack criticism. I had a lot of negative feelings like going into it. I think it was, you know, the kind of thing where initially I was like, oh, this is going to be a takedown. But then I think it became something that was, I think, hopefully a little bit more empathetic and more sort of about diagnosing a particular cultural situation that we're in, which I think is kind of defined by a certain unreflexive kind of regurgitation of ideas or information rather than something that, you know, I think the value of criticism is being able to analyze something and thinking about it critically. Whereas I think Badeau writing, which I think dominates criticism today, is something that is more just a description and maybe details about the person and the experience of seeing the work, but doesn't really offer so much to the reader, I don't think, in terms of analyzing artworks or contextualizing them in a way that is compelling or critical.
Right. It's interesting. I think what interested me a lot about your essay too is that, as you say, it revolves around this figure of like the 19th century Badeau. Would you explain what that personage, let's say, is?
Yeah, so that's very important context, of course. So I guess the Badeau was basically, you would think of them in terms of like the opposite of the flâneur. So the flâneur is the more well-known figure. It's the figure a lot of artists want to sort of imagine themselves as being. The flâneur is the person who, would walk the streets and they would observe, but they would be sort of detached from the scene. Whereas the badaud would be somebody who would be sort of immersed. It basically translates to somebody who is like a gawker or a gawper, kind of like open-mouthed, like, oh, look at what I'm seeing. And so, I mean, this translates in a sense to art criticism because I think there is something about that, like, pleasure in shock and pleasure in tawdry detail and like the details of the event, the wine that was there, the people that were there, rather than thinking about art as something that is maybe different to the immediate experience. I'd kind of been inspired as well, I suppose, by I should probably mention, there's a few things I don't want to bore you, but a
Not
book
at all.
came out in 2022 by Bridget Aldorf's called Gawkers, and it was about impressionism, like mostly impressionism, post-impressionism. It's a really amazing study of the figure of the badaud and how they emerge in Parisian art. And I mean, it's something that kind of I'd been thinking about because I'd been thinking about Pierre Bonnard as well. I'd been writing about him in 2022, and I've been trying to get a publication together about French Impressionism, but that's beside the point. It just all kind of culminated in thinking about what I'm doing as a critic and what I see other people doing.
You write in a way that I find really interesting, then, about like the badaud, social reportage, and self-referentiality and criticism. I mean, you've kind of just mentioned it now too, talking about like, the wine at an opening, et cetera, instead of talking somehow about like the art. Why do you find this tendency problematic? Is it because on some level, anybody with like a Substack or with like an Instagram feed can be a critic?
No, I should really point out that it's definitely not that kind of binary between like legacy media and, Substack and Patreon podcasts or whatever, because it probably does come across that way. I think of this sort of self-referential and, personal narrative style as something that is completely pervasive and, it's actually encouraged by legacy media. I don't think it's inherently problematic. I mean, I think that it can be, really informative and really interesting if it's written by somebody who, I don't know, you don't want to use these terms. It's hard to avoid them, but someone who's maybe being sincere about their intentions, or, there is something important, I think, about describing, for example, stains on the gallery floor, like the bathroom facilities. That can be something that's interesting because it gives you a sense of, the economics behind the space, or the particular culture that's there. But I think when it becomes something that is more inward focused, well, not even inward, because I don't want to suggest it's something that's particularly personal. I don't think it is. I think it has the pretense of being personal, but it's more about the experience socially and transactionally with the gallery and with the people in the art scene. So I think that the thing that can become problematic about this kind of writing is that it becomes, a lot of people have said this of, art criticism and reviews lately. They seem more like press releases or, interviews with the artists, like different kinds of publicity. And I think that there is like a disturbing sort of definitional problem going on in art criticism, where a lot of people, I think, go into writing reviews and they don't know that, it might be maybe a little, I don't know, not even necessarily unethical, but like compromising in some way to have a conversation with the artist and have them know that you're writing the review. I don't know what the culture is elsewhere, but in Australia, it's truly, I got like an aggressive email from an artist once after I'd written like a really positive review of their work. Like it wasn't flowery or like, oh, this is amazing, but it was a really positive review. And they seemed really angry that I hadn't come to them to talk about the work before I wrote it. But I think that just speaks to how entirely embedded this idea of like everybody's connected, everybody's talking all the time. There isn't something separate that you're doing when you're writing criticism. It's embedded in somehow the social reality of being in the art world.
It's quite an interesting phenomenon. It's funny, we recently Also, for this podcast series, we are releasing a panel discussion on the topic of the bad review. And it kind of circles around some of the questions that you just mentioned, but in particular, this idea of like, what is a bad review? Is any kind of review a good review? Like, because on some level, it's like eyes on the work, etc. But this question of maybe objectivity is the wrong word, but also lending a name to a review, a critic having a name in particular became a big topic of conversation during the discussion. This question, kind of, that I had been interested at one point in talking about too, was a bit this idea that sometimes on Instagram, or like not just on Instagram, online in general, let's say, there's a tendency to be able to make a certain kind of like commentary about things without actually signing your name. So not having kind of an authorship behind the words that you use and the repercussions of that. But it's interesting too what you say about kind of like the possibility that the meaning of a particular artwork is locked in with the artist, and there's sort of like a relationship between, you know, the artist is like a key to understanding something fundamental, and you need to kind of have access to that person in order to have access to something about what's going on in the work, because it also speaks back to this question, this sort of this genre, if we turn back the clock a bit, of new journalism, which you also discuss in the essay, which I found quite interesting, because I do find, especially amongst myself and my peers, new journalism is evidently like quite an important reference and quite an important niche that's kind of become popular again. One of my questions, I guess, from this is, what do you think, I guess, new journalism offered that feels sort of absent now? I'm weary of making it too much of a binary, like new journalism good, now it's bad. But I'm kind of curious about what your take about what's missing in, or what could be missing in the kind of current social reportage Badaud phenomenon.
I suppose the thing about new journalism and maybe the difference between new journalism and Badaud writing, I don't, well, what's missing? I don't necessarily think that it's so different. I think that really new journalism planted the seeds for Badaud writing, and a lot of new journalism, in a sense, has the same issues. So one of the critiques that also, I should say, was kind of a driving influence in my article was Christopher Lash's critique of, I think he calls it, if I remember correctly, pseudo self-insight. So just have a look. Maybe I have the quote here. It's just this wonderful line that he talks about the fictionalization of the personal narrative or the expression of the inner self. You know, he describes it as becoming this sort of parody of the inner self. And he's talking there about people like, I mean, I think John, like Tom Wolfe, is it Paul Zweig, some of those kind of early, like key figures in new journalism, Norman Mailer, particularly as well. But the thing is, I mean, yeah, I don't want to be too negative about new journalism because I think it's really interesting. Somebody like Tom Wolfe, he was an insider who could write with flair, and I think he was also somebody who, you know, there were things at stake. So it's a completely different context now, I think, because as well, you know, you can say that new journalism is now becoming more popular again. I appreciate that maybe new journalism as like a genre that was popular, you know, connected to the 70s and the 60s and has this sort of sense of like countercultural clout. You know, it's really interesting now and people are rediscovering these authors. I think there's something particular about that. But the sort of energy of new journalism and that sort of idea of externalizing the internal self and focusing on personal experience, it hasn't left our culture. It's become the dominant mode. You know, I think there's this tendency that we have often to kind of romanticize the first sort of burst of transgressive action, which, you know, then becomes sort of repeated and, you know, reified. But new journalism, you know, it's important because it was actually subverting something. Like it was different to be writing in a way that was like talking about what's going on in your life. And it gave a sort of sense of what the 70s was, and that's something that is like incredibly important to, where we've ended up and what's going on now. But these people were also really interested in literature. They were really well read. They hadn't been, raised, come of age in a culture that is entirely obsessed with the self in the way that we have. I think there is something, yeah, sorry, I feel like I'm aware that I'm maybe rambling, but I think that there is something really key about that rediscovery of new journalism and that reinvestment in interest. And I think it's particularly because we've seen a complete perversion of it. But at the same time, I think you need to be wary of the fact that a lot of these authors, they were already exhibiting, the traits that I think are quite problematic now. Like it was just the first seeds of that.
The other thing it sort of reminds me of in your article is this sort of this part of your article that discusses how Badeau writing in particular is also using what you'd call informal language quite liberally. It's an interesting kind of, let's call it can be seen as a bit of a subversion of like an academic register, I would say in particular, and how the more like the art, a particular scene of Badauds or of writers or of artists are trying to kind of like find a dialogue or find a way, I don't know, beyond, I suppose, like what for a long time was an academic register. But interestingly enough, I mean, what's the academic register is something that's taught to us, some of us, in a certain moment. I wonder, what do you make of kind of the informal use of language that is quite liberal? Like, do you see it as something that's like ironic or post-ironic or self-conscious?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, the way that you phrased it also, you've got me a little bit stumped. I suppose that the way that I feel about it is that, not to kind of reiterate this concern with pseudo subversion, but it has just become something that's so embedded in the way that people write. It doesn't feel like it really has, I don't know, I think every bit of fun has sort of been wrung from it. I don't think it has, it does the thing that people want it to do. It's something that maybe in the 80s or the 90s, it would feel still like, oh wow, there's like swear words here. But, now it's like people take mugs to work that have bad words on them. There's like self-help books that I think are like, I don't know. It's something that is completely embedded in mainstream culture, and it is like, I think, I guess it, I guess it's just this idea of anti-intellectualism, which is completely normal and has also been totally absorbed by the university as well, that is the problem. I think that you could say that slang, maybe there's a specificity of the language that could be interesting. Like you could talk about particular urban cultures and the way that they've used them and the way that that's kind of integrated into artworks or art communities. Definitely there'd be some interesting studies of that, but for the most part, it feels like this sort of gentrification of urban language, and I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with it or there's anything wrong with using it, because it's like, if you're just riffing, that's how you communicate with your friends. But I think it is used in cynical ways where it suggests familiarity and it suggests a kind of hostility towards ideas. And in the past, there was this idea that you would use slang or you would be sort of crass and you would say, like, oh, you can still be smart and, consume trash culture. But now it just feels like that's actually smuggling a complete hostility to critical thinking and art. I think that's something that's broadly the problem with this sort of popism and celebration of popular culture and talking about celebrity culture, which does also seep into art criticism somehow. And I'm hesitant to like have this conservative view of it, but
No,
I don't know,
no,
maybe this anecdote can help. Like I was thinking before about slang, and I don't know, this is something I noticed 10 years ago, and I promise this is relevant.
no.
But I would notice my friends using new slang, like, or just people I'd see at parties, they'd be using like new slang words, but they would use them without respect to their meaning. It would just sort of be, just kind of awkwardly inserted into sentences or conversations. And you could tell that they were doing it because they wanted to signal that, like, I'm up with the kids' language, like, I know what's going on. And it didn't, it feels funny to me in that way. That feels like the same thing as, like, pretentious academics using words without really using them properly, or, just dropping a reference to Walter Benjamin. And, it has this sort of arrogance and, false importance about it. But because it's something that's like low culture, people imagine that it's important and funny and, shaking things up.
There's a note I made when I was reading your article, but you mentioned it quite well, I guess, with this idea of like anti-intellectualism. I also wrote, which maybe is a bit of a push too far, like anti-historicity. But I was thinking a lot about this quote of yours in which you write, "Knowledge in this case is a kind of ownership signaled merely by awareness of a topic by the undiscerning observer who enjoys the clout of having traversed cultural terrain deemed unsavory or edgy." And I liked it because it seemed to me to also signal, this is maybe a bit of a push too, but some kind of relationship to language, to thinking that had been kind of, proposed by like deconstructionist thinkers at some point and then later abandoned when that project also kind of was abandoned for several reasons. I suppose a question I would ask is, what do you think the important distinction is between like reportage or and criticism?
I think maybe they can be, they can coexist, like they can commingle. You can write something that is sort of a scene report and sort of art criticism, but I don't necessarily think that you should. I think it's something that not many people can do very successfully. I suppose it would feel like it was more important if it wasn't something that seemed so ubiquitous. I think that now it's become such a standard in art criticism that there is some reflection on the space or the people involved that, that there is a sort of air of pseudo insight about acknowledging the context where you're not actually giving more detail about what that means or why these things are important. So I should say, like, it is interesting, and I think it can be good to have a kind of documentation of what a scene was like. Like, not everything needs to have some sort of critical edge or insight, but it's just like we need actually more critical edge and insight. There needs to be something that is more like, what does it mean that this was like this? What does it mean that this person said this thing? Not just, can you believe this person said this thing? So I know I'm talking maybe in a little bit vague sense, but the section that you were referring to before, where I talk about that sort of people dropping references to, edgy figures or, current events. I think that there is something important about acknowledging how dubious it is to kind of use people as props in this way. Because I think something about this sort of social reportage and the fact that it's so ubiquitous and it's become, such a style that people enjoy is that people don't end up actually giving a interesting recording of or re reporting of what's going on. They have a sort of set of like stock responses or, stock phrases, cliches that they use to describe things. So, often I'll see it when it'll be talking about. Well, I mean, in Australia, there'll be things like, oh, I'm going to this particular fair, or I'm going to, like, in regional rural Australia, there's like rodeos and things like that. And there'll be like reportage of, some inner city person going to see like what the fuss is about. And it has this, I mean, interestingly, it feels like a very kind of cosmopolitan, like French perspective of like, let's see what the provincials are doing. And you think that could be interesting, but it's just a complete, it's just an excuse for them to say the things that they already believe. Like, you can tell that they're going there and they're experiencing these things, but what's interesting is they're not actually experiencing them. Like, their preconceived idea of what these things are is completely eclipses what's actually going on. They know what they're going to write before they write it. They know what they're going to write before they go to the event. And I think that's when social reportage can become something that's kind of, a true perversion of what would be interesting about, or what was interesting about, Victorian social reportage or even new journalism.
Yeah, that's another line that I really liked so much, which was this line about like Morley Music's lament of his own writing aspirations. It made me laugh. He says, "What I really wanted was to be a 19th century journalist, which is to say, hardly a journalist at all, just someone who wanders around a city recording trivial observation and inventing lies." And this for me was quite, I had a good laugh about this, like, kind of aspiration, shall we say.
Yeah, because I mean, what's funny about it is that it is something that, I mean, yeah, maybe I'm being duped. Maybe it's really foolish of me to even take it seriously because it's like people aren't even lying about their intentions. And, it seems like, I don't know, I think other people feel this. I've talked to other people who feel this. There is like a hostility to caring about things. Like that makes you really lame and that's really dumb. And I find that, yeah, it seems so pervasive, and it makes you feel foolish for trying to level a critique. It's like people kind of know what they're doing. It sort of isn't even something that's being concealed. I mean, it's being flaunted sometimes.
Indeed. Another sort of defining feature of the Bedo that I thought was worth to discuss was this question of like attentiveness that you mentioned in particular. So like the Bedo has to be very much like up to date on the contemporary moment in order to sort of stay to continue kind of its status as the Bedo. I kind of wondered based off of that observation, whether you saw this idea of like this 24/7 attention economy kind of shaping criticism in general, so shaping kind of the things that were coming out of it.
Definitely, because there is this interest in always being topical. Like one thing I kind of notice about, and I realize that maybe I've been speaking a little bit vague here, and I think that there is a little bit of vagueness within the article, perhaps because I don't cite too many. I cite a few, and I've been pulled up on that, but I don't cite too many references. Like I don't want to target too many people because I think that it is, pretty ubiquitous. Like I think it's. You can't necessarily blame certain people, but I'm thinking Dean Kissick, I'm thinking Times Square, I'm thinking stuff that comes out of that. But there is this sort of tendency to want to just say like, whatever's going on in the news cycle, or I guess this sort of the para news cycle, like the Times Square, like edgy internet culture cycle. It has to be some kind of reference to that. There has to be maybe some sort of accelerationist point to be made. We'll match that with, a vague reference to Donna Haraway or something that's been trendy on and off since the 80s, something like that. But it doesn't allow space for depth. Like I guess I think that most people that I kind of admire, I think write well, are people who have like a specific set of reference points that they're completely invested in, like they have a real fidelity to. So, it might be like, it might be Marx and Engels, it might be Adorno, it might be, Walter Benjamin, but there's a depth of knowledge that I think can inform kind of a life's work. And when you're just trying to stay up with contemporary events and also contemporary theory, contemporary, I don't know, para theory, whatever, you're only really skimming the surface. There's this constant cycle. There's this new generation of work that isn't really that substantial. Whereas the alternative of, sticking to your references, it's framed as being something that's lazy or obsolete. But I mean, I think that having that depth of knowledge about particular ideas or particular theories is actually something that can help you approach the future. Like, I mean, I think you mentioned anti-historicity before, and I think there's something kind of interesting. And I mean, I think it is very kind of a Badu writing tendency to sort of want to forget history. It's become this sort of tendency in, I think a lot of art theory to just not want to think about anything before the 60s. It's always just like, oh, we were unenlightened. Like history is this dark void of bad things and bad people. Whereas it's like, I don't know, like I think I appreciate difference, but I think we're a lot more similar than we acknowledge. Like, I mean, you can read things from hundreds of years ago and just have like a human experience and be like, oh yeah, that is something that I can relate to because I'm also human. I think I went a bit off track there, but yeah, I mean, I think there is something disturbing about what's being created when we're just obsessed with the new and what's happening right now, and everything has to sort of center around that. One thing I'd add to that is I sort of think that, when you are invested in just thinking about like, what is the new thing? You think that the new thing is the right thing. And, it changes your way of approaching the world. And it encourages this sort of, I don't know, I would say like learned uselessness where, I think people refer to it as like living on the for you page. This is maybe a bit of an unfair anecdote, but a friend of mine was telling me a story which I think kind of reflects this. They were like, oh, I saw this reel the other day, and a woman cut a sweet potato really thin and put it in the toaster, and then you can use that as like a substitute for toast. And she was like, isn't that amazing? Isn't that incredible? And I was just like, you did that 10 years ago when it was trending and you didn't like it. But people just forget. Like, it's just this new thing is the good thing and it's cool and nobody's ever thought of it before.
I'm kind of glad that you also mentioned this idea of like pre-1960s, because one of the things that has been kind of an ongoing topic that I think is worth discussing is also this move between like the 19th and the 20th century on the topic of like how we think about art in particular, which I think as individuals who are kind of navigating contemporary postmodernist, however you would describe it, like art world, to think about, the end of the 19th century is sort of like feels like it was 300 years ago or something, but it's not. And the other, as Proust would say, like nothing seems further than the recent past. But one of the things that it's been really interesting to think about, I think, within that framework of like the end of the Victorian era and the Industrial Revolution, is also this question of like how modernism does away with a lot of things that are going on in the Victorian era, in particular at the level of like thinking. So the way we think, the way we like see art, the way we sort of like Clement Greenberg, et cetera, there's really a lot of changes and they're quite fundamental. So when you look back at the 19th century, it seems, yeah, like histor I mean, it really does seem like history, capital H. It's interesting too to kind of like discuss with like different academics or friends also this kind of move, especially when you're kind of constantly in the present moment, because the other thing that I was keen to discuss with you is this sort of like status of like the avant-garde, and I think like the contemporary moment in a way kind of being obsessed with trying to always understand what the avant-garde is, but the question of how we periodize it is kind of in general nowadays feels a bit complicated. My question regarding the avant-garde was, do you see this kind of the figure of like the Badauds' attention or hyper-attentiveness, a desire to like lock on to a moment, perhaps in the hopes that later it will be historically important, so later it'll be deemed to be a kind of an era of an avant-garde or something?
Maybe this is foolish on my part, but I really don't think that there is a serious consideration of posterity in Badauds writing. And I don't think that in our cultural moment there is necessarily much thinking about like creating a legacy. I guess you could say that in academia, and I think in para academic spaces too, you see the obsession with creating kind of gimmicky neologisms or whatever is something that people think of as like making their name. But I don't, maybe I'm being unsympathetic. I feel like it is something that's usually only an investment in the near future. And, I doubt that it's a sincere investment in thinking of something as being important in a historical sense, but maybe that's my own cynicism. I guess I would say though that, sometimes it is. Like, I think that maybe right now we're going through a moment that is like incredibly, I think this is gonna, yeah, I think this is a very crucial time that we're in presently, like mid 2020s. Like, Trump 2.0. I guess as an art critic who's maybe more invested in thinking about art as something that can mark the moment, I kind of think that maybe film is something that's doing that more than art is. Like, I mean, we're obsessed with thinking about the avant-garde, but I think that the things that are kind of important to our moment and recording our moment aren't happening in visual art. And I mean, visual art has just been something that's so, it's just been spread so thin. We've tried to make it into so many different things that I don't know, it's hard to even identify what it is, right?
Do you think, in a sense, the style of like no posterity, other academics have called it like immediacy is a good example, is in itself then something that could develop as a style itself or as like a cultural moment?
I don't know. Like I, yeah, I'm not sure. I think it is important to think about like the future, and I don't think that there are really that many sincere engagements. Maybe that's just my limited knowledge and my limited experience.
What do you think? I've been thinking also a lot in general about, the art world is often described as like a contact industry. So it's an industry built on like networks, dinners, studio visits, friendships, really like interpersonal relationships on some level are really foundational to how exhibitions and also criticism, et cetera, are sort of flowing throughout this ecosystem. What do you make of the argument that cultural capital and community ties are indispensable to the ecosystem? And then how would you see the role of the Badeau in this idea of cultural capital?
Yeah, I think that there is something, to be noted about maybe something like the term art worker. And, I think Sven Lüdeken has called it general performance. This idea that, now almost all of our time is occupied by different forms of work, which are, networking, they're messaging people, they're meeting for, going to openings, having coffees, things like that. I guess like I know that this is maybe me also being naive, and it could be counterproductive for a career, but I think more people should maybe ask the question of whether these are entirely transactional relationships or if they're based on like a genuine shared concern about creating good work or having productive conversations. The kind of thing I think about a lot of this, obsession with networking and, need to be at every opening, at every event, is that it takes a lot of time away from like when people could actually be doing work. And I mean, I feel like this is why we see so much art that is, I guess, just different iterations of relational art, like having a party is art, making a meal is art. I really just feel like this is like a further extension of this sort of, well, interestingly, I think it's actually like a kind of feminized art industry type who, is sort of taking up the role of like a 20th century society wife who'd like be in, daughters of the American Revolution and hold tea parties to bolster the career or the social standing of like her important businessman husband. Like, I think that there is something, really dubious about the confusion between art and socializing and work. And the Badeau is maybe like a brilliant example of this type, because the only thing that like a Badeau curator or critic produces is writing. And it's just writing that is something that is embedded in their social experience and the justification of their role at exhibitions, in relationships with artists, and so on.
Nowadays, do you see criticism functioning in general like a performance where the persona of the critic and presence becomes as important as what they actually say about the work? I don't know if you have in particular sort of like thoughts about this, like as a critic yourself.
Yeah, I mean, are you thinking of particular examples like
I guess
Jerry Saltz or
yeah, I mean these sort of figures, but I guess the follow-up question was also this idea of like what does the critic have to do and deliver that the Badaud cannot and does not? And maybe that's a question of like expertise in particular.
I guess in the context of like in this conversation and thinking about like art criticism and maybe the reason that the Badaud is such a prominent like way of being, I'd say like absolutely, they're completely intertwined. There is a particular kind of performance that is embedded in their social media, the way that they interact in the world, and of course their writing. I think that if you want to be sympathetic about it, it's because there isn't really, nobody gets to be Robert Hughes anymore. Like, you're not just going to be able to live your life as an art critic, just travel around, have enough money, have a good time. That's not something that's possible. So you do just need to create this sort of, you're just an influencer. You basically have to just be a social media presence and have a particular vibe about you. I mean, I think it's kind of funny. I don't know. This is, it's, I hate, yeah, I don't like personal reflection, but maybe it's relevant. Like, it's funny you were talking earlier about like what a negative review is. And I think that, I champion negative criticism and being critical, but I think it's kind of also shown me that people then just associate you with negative criticism. You're just the person that writes bad reviews. And I've never thought of myself as being that kind of person. And I think even when I write a negative review, I don't think it's like, well, not often, sometimes. It's not usually like particularly harsh or cutting, because I think that's also, a kind of just clout building activity, like, oh, you're just tearing someone down. I think like you should be generous even when you're being really critical. Like, you can have some quips, but you should still just be trying to, yeah. I think that if we're going to be positive, which I think we should be, I think you kind of see that people are just becoming increasingly fatigued with this stuff. Like, I think that there is like evidence of an interest in more sincere and I think engaged art criticism. I think that comes out with people's interest in things like the Manhattan Art Review. Like, regardless of what you think of it, like, you can see that there is like a sincere engagement with art, and it's sometimes a little bit about the social scene and what's going on. It's pretty informed about what's going on online, but that doesn't mean that it's, just about that. There is something more engaging and revealing about the context that's being offered there. And I think on Substack, similarly, you can see like this rise in people who are invested in writing sincere criticism and also kind of interestingly bringing back some of these early 20th century figures like Greenberg. I mean, we've seen like a massive reinvestment in reading Greenberg and thinking about things like Kitsch, even things like Wyndham Lewis. Yeah.
A note that I wrote down is on this topic of criticism in general, and the bad review and the good review, et cetera, is that on some level, criticism has to consider and situate things in a larger context. I'm within this conversation, it's interesting, I'm kind of two minds about it. That's somehow also the most challenging thing in this moment, too. It seems like this question of like anti-historicity, no posterity, trying to find a way to kind of make a framework to discuss an artwork in general or an exhibition is quite a challenge, and it's a bit the responsibility, let's say, of the critic to try to find a way to do so. And maybe on the other side of that coin, I would say maybe this is sort of me thinking out loud. I wonder when there's no way to do so, or there's a kind of a confusion about how to do so, whether the result somehow is something more close to social reportage, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is ways of situating things that, it doesn't have to be necessarily grand. I think that there is, a great abundance of art criticism that can sort of make quite loose but substantial connections between the art and political situations or what's going on. I do think a lot of it is very cynical or, very much just trying to sort of cement things in the moment. But, even if there isn't necessarily a kind of cohesive narrative or monoculture that you can relate things to, I think that art today, even if it doesn't have a history or, it's coming from a moment that's so fragmented, it can still provide an amazing manifestation of like cultural symptoms. Like, I think what a good critic can do is they can look at something and identify where it's come from and maybe see like a broader lineage. Because, like I was saying before, as much as people might not be intentionally responding to things or it might not be, part of a particular legacy, like we're all human. And I think it's not foolish to try and connect things to the past. And it's not necessarily a conservative move either. In terms of what art criticism is, in terms of the trying to find like a distinction between art criticism and social reportage, like I think that maybe one thing that, if we could make it like an extra thing that it often is it is often also like just visual description. Like I think that's maybe the worst thing actually, even though I've railed against like social reportage, like the worst thing that I think you can see, and maybe this is something that's more like, lower tier art criticism. It'll just be a description and a reiteration of the artist's statement. And I mean, that's like the worst thing. I think a good critic is somebody who, I mean, maybe this is foolish and too ambitious, but they can combine all three. That can be an acknowledgement of context. That can be sincerely good visual description. I mean, I know that sounds like a silly point, but I really don't think people look at art enough. And then it can also have some sort of historical grounding or some sort of grounding in like a broader knowledge base or a political investment.
I mentioned it sort of earlier, but I kind of wanted to ask in a way, maybe more like directly, do you have any particular sort of thoughts about the current moment of art history in which we find ourselves, or have you thought of like a name or a genre for it, apart from this kind of idea of like no posterity? Or do you think maybe it's more of like a transitional phase? It's a bit more of like a speculative question, but I'm curious in what you think.
I'm really not sure, and I think it's really difficult to diagnose because, like you were mentioning earlier, in terms of, what it meant to move from the Victorian era to the 20th century, there is something very big going on, and I mean, as an art critic, I mean, I think of it often as like, through cultural terms. And one thing that I think is really big right now, and I think you see it manifesting in, particular cultural products, like, for example, Almodóvar's last film, A Room Next Door, is the death of the bourgeois subject. And I mean, I know that the bourgeois subject is somebody who is, kind of reviled as like, compared to the Philistine, but I think the bourgeois subject, there's still somebody who was sort of informed about art and who valued art education, albeit in maybe a superficial way. But now you're kind of seeing this sort of, I would call it like an investment in systems and efficiency, and I don't know, this complete deference to pop culture taking over. Like there is, we might have judged 10 years ago that kind of character who was like, very stuffy and like pseudo-intellectual, interested in Cézanne or whatever, but that kind of era is ending. And so I kind of wonder what's coming next. And I think the Badaud is maybe part of that transition.
Yeah, I was about to say it's funny because on some level you think about that character and you think, yeah, but at least he's like earnestly or like genuinely interested in Cézanne and has things to say about the work of Cézanne in a way that is also
Yes, yeah.
interesting and like not enlightening, maybe is the wrong word, but curious. It's thought through, it's engaged. You know what I mean? It's like really making contact with something.
I don't know if they necessarily. I don't know if they necessarily always were. Like, I mean, I think there's some great critiques of that kind of bourgeois character, but yeah, it was. Now I think, like in retrospect, we can really appreciate how cynical it is to mock that,
Yeah.
like investment in looking at art and thinking about art, and you can kind of see the decline of these sorts of events, which would be like. In Australia, you'd have that kind of public, like semi-scholarly lecture whenever there'd be like a winter masterpieces exhibition, and it would be attended by like a lot of older people who are maybe like lawyers, people who are teachers. Like it was kind of a great community vibe, and it was wonderful to see people genuinely engage with art and have, at least serious conversations. That could be serious. Like sometimes they could be very critical, sometimes they could be very informed, sometimes not, but it was still something that was really beneficial to everybody involved.
Yeah, no
But
doubt.
now we have, Star Wars Lego and Labubu.
Yeah, indeed. Honestly, like I think that the vagueness of your article actually is a strength because I think it works well that it doesn't like it seems to like impl like I like this. I like that it implies something that's very concrete, I think, if you're like a person that pays attention in general without like calling out those people. Like I did to a friend of mine who's an artist who also writes, who's quite like interesting, careful, and considered. And it was funny because I think the first thing that he thought is he was like, oh my gosh, do I do that? And I felt like, okay, but maybe that's an interesting part of the article in general, is that you should like wrestle with your own your own personal implications, like and like how you're operating or how you're thinking. And it's not a diss, but it's like also it's an opportunity to like move something forward, like as a community, as like as people who like think and like care about art, to really decide to like care more or something, and like that the stakes are, you know what I mean, like serious. So that I that's actually one of the things I liked the most about it, is like that there's like a level of there's stakes, but there's yeah there's a care about like the thing itself. It's just this kind of more like shiny things on the outside.
I really like that you say that you enjoyed the vagueness, is that I think that something that we haven't had for many years, and there's reason to this because you want to sort of respect that we're in a fragmented culture and this plurality of opinion and ideas, but something that people like Christopher Lash did, and even like really good new journalists could do, was that they could, think about this sort of broader picture and bring things together. And sometimes that was vague, and sometimes that was generalizing in a way that was problematic, but it gave you a sense of something. Like it didn't like necessarily tick every single box. It couldn't get every single thing right, but that broad picture, like I feel like we're seeing more things, and that's what Substack is doing. People are writing things that kind of aim to do that more, and that's something that I think we're kind of our culture failed a bit not doing that for a while, so I'm kind of excited to think that that might be returning,
Yeah, it's a bit like the like the
and
zoo.
criticism's a good space for it.
Totally. I mean, I also liked this kind of that new journalist took things, but then they presented it like undigest. Reminded me a little bit of like how I was first writing, like when I was like 18, maybe. Yeah, 18, first in university, and like I didn't really know how to make an argument yet in writing. So sometimes you were just like you would say all this stuff and you would kind of assume that your TA would be able to connect the dot. Like you were, but that was also a question of like not being able to form an argument, not knowing how yet, and also assuming that if you say certain things, that the dots between those things connect themselves, and then being told as a person who writes, you have to connect the dots. Like it's not enough to just say something. You also have to like, it's like when you have a quote, you can use a quote, but you have to say something about it either. You can't just, you know?
I mean that's so true, but I think it's also funny in that I feel like a lot of the vagueness that we're seeing now in the way that people write is also perhaps because, like I was saying before, with that kind of idea of writing these sort of general histories or these general cultural assessments, you can't get everything right. And I think that now a lot of people go through university and they learn how to make arguments, but they only do it in a fake way. I think that might be just like a last 10 years thing, but it will just be, a fear to commit to something that's too ambitious. So it will just be like a really, really simple essay and a really, really vague point. And I don't know, I would say maybe like, you learn formulas. Formulas are important, but it doesn't encourage like ambitious writing. And I think that a lot of the people who have learned to write box ticking assignments that aren't ambitious, one of the things that I sort of think that a critic should do, and I think, maybe more people should do, is like actually to be able to do it, you have to just be a bit detached. Like you can't be somebody who is like super in the scene. And it's just so hard because most people who are writing art criticism, like for the reasons that we've talked about, like you can't really have a job. That can't just be your job. You are all of these other things at the same time. So you are just embedded in other people's lives. Like ideally, you're probably not going to too many parties. You maybe have a small circle of friends, but you have a level of detachment where you can write about things and not be worried about offending your friend or causing some sort of friendship rift.
Or being like or having like precarious work. I mean, in the bad review panel, one of the main points, one of the main conversations actually, there was a book. It's got to be about 150 bad reviews that artists submitted. So they went out to a bunch of artists. They said, like, can you, if you don't mind, would you send us your bad reviews? Some people were like, I can't touch that. That's traumatic. Like, I really can't revisit that. Other people were like, no problem, and would send. And there's quite a range. I mean, one of the first ones that also made me laugh out loud was someone describes the sculpture of this woman as like unforgivable, like really intense, like. There's and some kind of like poetry in that too, just the and not all of them are well argued, but the point I'm trying to make actually is that one of the reviewers whose name comes up the most often is Roberta Smith from the New York Times, but it makes the most sense. She's like, that's her job.
Oh,
But it's like, that is her job, like she
yeah,
stakes of somebody like that is different because
yeah.
it's her position, and a lot of artists felt like in the reception to it that there was something positive about having their work actually engaged with on some level. So it's like where maybe, consensus isn't
Yeah.
always clear and not always going to be the case, still that somebody was at least had enough of an idea of care to engage with the ideas that the artwork was proposing and like put them into a form. I mean, that is a kind of form of care, positive or negative. You have to like that's contending, that's time, that's thoughts, that's not, it's not. That's not nothing, but so it kind of like flipped also this idea of the
I
battery.
mean, it's also interesting because, like, yeah, it is like, also, getting that bad review was like a really unique experience to just have like a sincere engagement where you might actually change something about the way that you're working. Because I mean, if somebody isn't just writing like a, just trying to take you down for fun, even if it, or even if they are, like if they've pointed out a couple of little things, it's just like, oh, well, that's something like you can build from that nobody's telling you. Because I don't know, once you're outside of university, you're not really getting any feedback. Like you're kind of in just like a set of particular circles and they usually, I mean, something that I really believe is that most artists aren't writers. And like one of the problems like with our art culture is that we've made all artists think that they're writers. Like it's literally a different language. Like you're doing something that is different. Maybe it's incorporating text, but it's not text in the way that like a catalog or a review is written. Like you are doing something differently. This is like your area. You're not somebody who can just do everything. But I mean, everybody thinks they can do everything. Everyone's an art worker. But yeah, I think that there is something really disturbing and corrosive about this sort of, I think it's a confusion between like facts and opinions too. Because I mean, one thing about, I think, writing negative reviews or writing reviews even that can be interpreted as negative is that even just not repeating the artist statement is something that people think of as like, oh, you've got factual inaccuracies. Like I've had two instances where people have sort of come after me and they've been like, there are factual inaccuracies in your review. And either what they mean is opinions, or in the one it was co-written, but in one issue it was one small factual inaccuracy. But their email was dedicated to like two sentences on that one small factual inaccuracy, but it opened the gates to four paragraphs reiterating their artist statement and how we misrepresented their art.
But it's also that, as you say, like, are artists meant to be like communicators in the same way that writers are? I don't think so. Like, are they meant to communicate like so directly? I'm not sure. You know, like you can get there with them, like in an interpersonal.
Yeah.
Is that what the art is meant to do? I'm not sure.
Well, I guess because it's also like you pointed out earlier that, the same with the writer as well, is the artist is now just so intertwined with their image. Like it's not like it's just their art, it's also their image. And, another problem is that I think people don't really care about criticism, and it's not something that's really, I don't think people really even understand what it is. So they have this need to control the public narrative about them. And I mean, it's not like it's a personal like critique of any person in particular. Like it's just this is culturally where we're at.
My final question for you is kind of about where you imagine or criticism might go in the next 10 years. I know that's a long period of time to think about, but do you think there's kind of like, do you see maybe in your own community like a certain trend for the direction of criticism even in the next few years?
I mean, I think I'm just repeating stuff that I've already said, but I really do just think people are becoming more invested in serious criticism, and there's going to be a little bit more. I mean, I hesitate to call it this, but I think there'll be more of an attempt to create adult culture rather than this sort of perpetual adolescent, fun, sort of semi-social reportage type criticism. I think that we're going to see a return to stuff that is more sincerely engaged, maybe like historically linked. I think you can already see it on Substack. I'm not sure about how legacy media will go, but I think you can already start to see a little bit of a swing back. That's what I think.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for this really insightful conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you about this article and hearing your thoughts, let's say, kind of like a year after you've written it.
Oh, thank you so much for being interested.
Thank you for listening to Fair Enough by Art Cologne and Texte zur Kunst, where ideas travel and perspectives expand. From the world's first art fair to today's conversations on modern and contemporary art, the dialogue continues every fall live in Cologne. For more information, visit artcologne.com.